For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Ortho Joe Show, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. In our world, orthopedic research is king, and current topics from our respective publications are analyzed weekly. Here is Mohit Bhandari from Ortho Evidence and Mark Swinkowski from the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery.
Well, good morning, Mo.
Morning.
I know you just got back from Hong Kong. I saw some interesting photos of you scaling up sheer walls in Hong Kong.
Uh-huh.
And you just got back last night, so I'm sure you need your cup of Joe.
Well, I will tell you that usually if I travel to places far and wide, I indulge in all the food and usually end up on a diet of liquids thereafter. So I won't go into the details, Mark, as to why I'm on a liquid diet. But the point of the matter is that I had a great time.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a wonderful experience to visit the institutions there. They have such a history and cutting edge research and really, really smart people. So
absolutely. It was great. And, you know, I think more than anything else, and you know, this is the exchange of ideas sometimes requires us to be present, actually there to interact with human beings and discuss and have discussions and plan things. So I think that was very fruitful for that period of time as well.
Yep. Zoom does have its place, but it also has its limitations.
Absolutely.
It's good. Well, this is the latest issue of the journal, dated April 19th. And there was a sticky on the cover, which and an editorial in that journal that introduced the latest program that's called OrthoCore. And I just want to make the audience aware that this is for everybody. What this is it's based on the StoryCorps program, which was created and founded about 15 years ago. And some of our listeners may have heard presentations on National Public Radio, but it is interviews, audio interviews. And it can be with, for example, a senior partner in a group that was a founding partner and may have had a seminal role, or a mentor that's been critical for somebody's development in the field of orthopedics. And there's some sample questions that are listed on the website, but and how to do it. Anybody can do it. And these are going to be preserved in perpetuity in the National Library of Congress. So the idea is to preserve these oral histories so that others can learn and appreciate what's gone on before them. And again, it's not just for egghead academics like you and I. It's for everybody in our field of musculoskeletal medicine and surgery. And the website is orthocore at jbjs.org. And I encourage every listener to think about hosting an oral history of some important aspect of their career. But also in this edition, I found a very interesting article that's about ACL reconstruction history, if you will. And it comes out of the Kaiser Permanente group, which has provided us with a lot of really good database information in the last 5 to 7 years or so. But it's an interrupted time series analysis measuring the impact of research and education on clinical practice. And the question they're looking after is allograft use in young patients, using their registry to track it. And basically, you know, the information that allografts are potentially inferior for younger actor patients really started to hit the books, if you will, in 2008 or so. And with the Moon Group, Kurt Spindler and Rick Wright and that group, which had a lot of important information about this question. But they looked in this ACL registry at 11,800 patients who are under 21 or equal to 21, who underwent primary reconstruction from 07 to 2017, and then analyzed it by quartiles. And they did an intervention that was evidence-based, providing data to their surgeons across the group. And the allograft utilization from at pre-intervention was 21%. And in the quarter one, which is 07-010, it stayed at 24.8%. And then it decreased in the quarter ending 2017 to 2.4%. So it's a timeline, really, of documenting the impact of disseminating information on clinical decision-making. And I just, what I really want to talk with you about is the whole issue, not only with ACL, and I know OE's got some information you're going to share about this that you ran last night, but the whole issue of how can we possibly speed up the way that information, high quality information, changes practice. That's what I really want to get to, but maybe first you could present what you learned from OE Mind on this.
Right. So, I mean, I think it's a fascinating topic in principle around how do you get information into the hands of the individuals who need to, and once they're in their hands, what do they actually do with it? And how do we persuade individuals? Part of it has to do with getting information to people quickly. So let me show you, if I could, a couple of slides here that highlight a little bit about where we've been going with OrthoEvidence. And if you take a look here, we have at OrthoEvidence, Mark, now amassed about 130 million data points worth of information from, you know, extracting information from each of these multiple randomized trials in orthopedics. So in the back end, we're able then to do rapid analysis. So this meta-analysis is a tool that we've created in the back end that is called the OE Meta Analyzer. And basically what we can do is we can type in, you know, in this case, anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction. We can type in sort of the age groups. We can type in also autograft versus an allograft reconstruction. And you press basically a button, and within about 2 minutes, we're able to generate these analytics. And remember, all the trials have been previously evaluated through our own search strategies, and all of the risk of bias has already been evaluated in the past already, because the database, it does that just by its, you know, just by the way we function. But the thing that became very evident is that when we look just even at midterm outcomes, you know, five-year outcomes in this particular case, I mean, allograft does not perform with respect to function at all. And if you look over time with respect to function even, right, if you look at time with respect to function, we can forecast it. So again, you can press another one of the tools we have is called a forecaster, which looks back at the first trials and kind of cumulatively adds up the cumulative evidence over time. And if you look back, exactly what you said, around 2009, you know, there was a pretty clear messaging from randomized trials that, you know, that autograft was superior to allograft. But take a look. I mean, that confidence interval just got narrower and narrower and narrower. Remember, everything below the red line suggests favors autograft. So really, there's never been a situation where we've really been uncertain, actually, right? The confidence interval suggests we've always been certain. And, you know, the truth is, where do we go from here? Well, I'll just stop here after this. But, you know, right now, there are about 42 randomized trials being conducted around the world on ACL areas. There are about 21 studies to be completed in the next 30 days, about 114 sites and about 11,000 some odd patients. So there's a lot of interest in the ACL. It behooves us to be thinking, well, with all this information, how do we absolutely find a way to ensure that information gets out as quickly as we get it in? So the one thing I would say to you is that it's no surprise, but actually quite shocking that we've known about allografts for as long as we have. So you would assume that this information would be disseminated widely.
Right. And I think you told me that you ran this analysis last night. So it's not like, right? I mean.
Oh, right. Yeah. So the power. So just as we know, you and I were chatting just offline about, you know, ChatGPT and AI and machine learning. Well, you can imagine now that the era of the almost instantaneous meta-analysis is here. I mean, like, we're on the back end testing this. We haven't put it live yet. We haven't made it public yet, really. We're doing it internally, but I can generate 4,000 to 5,000 meta-analyses at a, you know, press of a button right now. So this one was done specifically for this question. And you can see that, you know, it took me 5 minutes to get all those graphics. But I think the important part is that we're in an age now where information lag shouldn't be there. Like, we should be able to get information. You know, what used to take us months now takes us minutes.
Yeah.
So we're now in a point is, you know, what do we do with this information, Mark? Like, you know, like, we have a platform. How do we get it out to people?
Right.
What do we do? And our alternative methods. I mean, like, we think about textbooks. We think about journals. We think about all kinds of, you know, we think about the online sources that we're using to attempt. I think it's going to have to be a multi-prong approach, you know, to get information out.
Yeah, I want to chat a little bit more about that, but I would just make the observation that you're probably one of very few academics who, if you have the power of producing 4,000 analyses,
CVs are going to go through the roof. Yeah. No, I'm not. Yeah. I'll use it for good, Mark. I'll use it for good. Yeah,
it's exactly. Well, yeah, that's really a part of the discussion with ChatGPT, et cetera. Congratulations for not using that power you have for flooding the publication world with that. But yeah, so if I recall right, the issue of the dissemination of information, the really important article was published, I don't know, 15, maybe 20 years ago, about the use of aspirin and beta blockers for acute myocardial events. And it took 18 years for that to become the practice in 90%+ of institutions. 18 years. And think of all the lives that could have been saved with that very important condition if the dissemination could happen faster. So how are we going to get it out faster, and how are we going to get people's attention in this modern world to really pay attention to the data and consider changing practice? What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, if you look also historically back to just how long it takes, like, so we did a paper many, many years back, seems probably well over a decade back, but we looked at sort of all the big trauma trials, and we surveyed a number of orthopedic surgeons, 300 to 400, and we just asked them, you know, had they heard about these trials and what did they know about them? The truth is, the majority of surgeons hadn't heard about some of the major trials that had been conducted in the trauma field. And what was particularly important was, you know, $30 to $40 million cumulatively across all these trials had been invested, you know, through various agencies. It is a major, major waste of resource if we conduct these studies and we can't get the message out. The other general, you know, message I remember hearing all the way through my master's degree in HRM at McMaster was kind of like, after a paper is published, there's still this knowledge to translation gap, right? And that gap often is 2 years, even with very big programs, it's 2 years. So they used to go on about that. Don't just be happy that you've published the paper, right? Mm-hmm. Use and mobilize every possible channel you have to your disposal. Now, back then, the channels were presenting at major meetings. And I do think, Mark, the one thing that we definitely are seeing more of, but highlight papers of important at major meetings, like when you have, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 members of a fraternity, whether it's trauma or arthroplasty or, you know, sports, and they're in the same room, we have to take advantage of that. We can't have late-breaking trials or late-breaking practice-changing evidence that really should be fodder for everyone being presented in a small breakout with 40 people. Like, it needs to be, you know, sort of a central plan, you know, at all the major meetings. I would say that would be one pathway. But the more we collaborate, the more we get each of our tentacles in all these different countries. I know you travel a bit, I travel a bit. You travel because you build knowledge, and when you share knowledge very quickly. So those are all these, you know, there's nothing fancy about this, but we're now in an attention economy, and we have seconds to get people's attention. So how do we use novel approaches? I think some of the approaches, like getting on and chatting online and trying to reach our colleagues and friends, like the way we're trying to do, I think is important. And I just think, like, looking at alternative metrics, you know, for how we measure impact is going to become more and more important. But I do think, though, regardless of all that, it's still going to be years I mean, just look at anything. Just look at, it was a 12-year gap between the first, you know, documented case of, you know, orthopedic fractures and child abuse to when it became a law. You know, the work we've been doing on intimate partner violence is well over 15 years. And we're still seeing, we still had a paper rejected from a major trauma journal in which they said, we do not think orthopedic fractures as a result of fracture and intimate partner violence relates to the practice of an orthopedic trauma surgeon. It's still happening in December of 2022. The point is, it's advocacy, you know, and I think we just need many, many champions advocating for a cause. And I think the autograft is just another example of having many champions in many publications and repeated messaging on something that seems to be a signal.
Yeah, let me just just push you with one more question. Do you feel that social media has a role in disseminating information? Do you have experience with that or examples of that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I for myself personally, I don't use it for that purpose, but I know that, you know, if you look at Twitter, if you look at, you know, I mean, all of them, right, does make a difference, you know, it depends on your demographic, but, you know, it would strike me as though we have to be using every channel to get sound bites. Remember, we have but the sound bite needs to be clear. What happens sometimes is really impressive research is miscommunicated often by the researchers because they aren't able to simplify it into a sound bite that allows people to catch on to it. Yep. So, you know, I think part of this is that, you know, really thinking about the story and the key message. People remember one thing. And so if this was allograft should never be used again. Mm-hmm. Well, fair enough. That's the case. And that's where it should be. Allograft bad. Fine. Mm-hmm. Say that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you have about 5 seconds, about 5 seconds on social media.
Yeah,
I've learned that painfully. So
one nuance, though, allograft bad and young activate.
Yes. Yeah. Correct.
So right. It's a nuanced message.
Yeah. But I do think you would have to make sure that messaging, you know, was put out in a way that made a lot of sense.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, it's been wonderful chatting with you about ACL, something that neither of us have much personal experience with, but it's a very common and important condition.
Absolutely.
Sport and other activities. And I think we need to keep thinking about the real metric for the publication world ought to be change in practice in a way to measure that and report that. That's something we should be thinking about.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, just to point out, when you see what your colleagues are doing, your peers are huge influencers on your day-to-day practice. So in a hospital-based practice, for example, or a practice, you know, in a community-based practice, feeding information back and letting your colleagues know, if 4 or 5 of your colleagues are doing B and you're doing A, you have more of a reason to either justify why you're doing A or you start rethinking why you're doing A, right? Mm-hmm. And that becomes a really interesting discussion. But I think those discussions have to be had, and it starts always with evidence.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I hope you're off the apple juice soon and able to get back
to a cup of joe. Yeah, I will.
I wish you a speedy recovery. And
thank you so much.
Travel carefully, maybe more so next time.
More so. Well, thing is, it doesn't matter. You know, you go there and you just start eating everything and enjoying it.
Yeah, good.
You can't say no to good food, right? So
yeah, it's very difficult indeed.
I know.
Yeah. Have a great day, Mo.
All right. Take care. Yeah.
Bye-bye. See ya.
Yeah, bye.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.